Support for this public radio podcast comes from Thrivent Financial, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thriventfinancial.com/retirement.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Last week, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson coined a new term to describe the economy, downcline. Well, this week, some are worried about a more well-known term.
Economists and other policymakers just don't like to use the word. It's such a bummer.
Yeah, it's a bummer. That's former Labor Secretary Robert Reich with this week's Marketplace Money Inside quote. Now, I ask you, what word does Reich say is so dreaded these days? Is it A, stagflation, that old chestnut from the 70s describing high inflation and slow growth? Or is it B, meltdown, because comparing the economy to a nuclear disaster does not inspire confidence? Or is the term C, depression? Many say we're in a recession now. Could the R word turn into the D word? Pick one and stick around. The answer is on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. So, who's going to solve this housing mess? Anybody got an idea? Anybody? Anybody? Bueller? I'm sure Uncle Sam in Wall Street would love to hear it. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement.
This week, all three presidential candidates outlined their thoughts on the housing crisis. John McCain said the government should not bail out lenders or borrowers who, quote, act irresponsibly. Barack Obama proposed a $10 billion foreclosure prevention fund. And Hillary Clinton called for legal protection for mortgage companies that help homeowners modify their loans. Meanwhile, the private sector is struggling to come up with its own fixes. This week, some former executives of Countrywide announced the creation of a new company called, deep breath here, Private National Acceptance Company, LLC, PennyMac for short. The company plans to buy up risky loans to help struggling homeowners stay put. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
PennyMac will go to banks and offer to buy distressed mortgages from them on the cheap. Christopher Thornburg is with Beacon Economics.
What they will say to the bank is, we will buy this mortgage from you at a discounted rate, but that rate will still be above what you would get paid back if this home goes into foreclosure.
For many banks, he says, the offer will come as a big relief. It'll allow them to clear bad or risky loans off their books, and that'll improve their image with shareholders. Stan Kurland is PennyMac's CEO. He says once PennyMac owns the mortgage, the company will work with the homeowner to restructure the debt. That doesn't mean that homeowners have to brace themselves for a man with a briefcase knocking on the door, although they might. Kurland says most of the time they'll be able to arrange the restructuring online or over the phone.
We'll be looking at their current credit status, what's the value of the property, what is their past experience been in terms of the mortgage, you know, job status.
And several other factors to determine how the owner can keep his home and pay off the loan. PennyMac starts making money when the borrower resumes paying interest. It stands to make big profits when the mortgage is finally paid down. Kurland says the company plans to buy whole mortgages rather than pools of sliced and diced debt. He says they're not ruling out buying those mortgage-backed bonds later on. Christopher Thornburg says he's not surprised PennyMac is holding off. He says those kinds of securities present a legal minefield to investors. A whole mortgage is a much more straightforward proposition.
Once you buy it from the holding bank, it's yours. There's no secondary considerations of bondholders and things like that in the background you need to deal with. So it is a much cleaner transaction.
Which, with a little bit of tweaking, can start paying interest relatively quickly. Jay Weiser teaches real estate at Baruch College in New York. He says there's an irony here. Former Countrywide executives made money lending to people who, in a pinch, probably couldn't keep up the payments. And now they're making a buck rescuing those very same homeowners. Still, Weiser says, if PennyMac succeeds, it could act as an injection of antifreeze into a frozen market.
The way that busts get cleaned up and liquidity is restored is when somebody liquidates stuff at the bottom. So to the extent there's a buyer, these banks now have more capital, perhaps they can make more loans, and perhaps the market in general will get a little calmer.
Weiser says when PennyMac buys these loans, it won't just siphon money back into the banks, it'll pump confidence back into the economy. Then, once lenders get back to lending, buyers can get back to buying, and the market and the economy can get back to growing again. I'm Ashley Milne-Tight for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement and by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more online at saveandinvest.org.
We got an interesting question from one of you last week. What's the difference between a recession and a depression? Now, before we go any further, let's just acknowledge that there is still some debate, though not much, about whether we're even in a recession, much less a depression. But we decided to ask Marketplace commentator and Berkeley professor Robert Reich to join us for some history and Econ 101. Welcome to Marketplace Money.
Well, thank you, Tess.
What are the traditional definitions of a recession first and also a depression? How are they different?
Well, a recession is now officially defined as 2 quarters, that is 6 months, where the economy suffers negative economic growth, where the economy actually shrinks. Now, a depression, there is no official definition of a depression. I think one reason is that economists and other policymakers just don't like to use the word. It's such a bummer. But in common parlance, it means a very, very severe recession. High unemployment, businesses pulling way, way back from investing, and all of the other things that happen during a recession, just more so.
Do those definitions still hold in what we call the new economy? I mean, you mentioned these 2 consecutive quarters of negative growth. We have not seen that yet, but so many people are saying we are in a recession.
Yes, I think people are assuming we're in a recession because all of the indicators are trending in that direction. Unemployment seems to be moving upward, and then businesses are pulling back. You know, if you're somebody like me who looks at the economic data that come in over the transom, it's just bad news.
It certainly feels like that. But how deep and long would the current recession, assuming we're in one, have to be to turn into a depression?
Well, again, because there's no fixed definition of a depression, nobody really knows. I would say that unemployment would probably have to reach 8 or 9%. We haven't seen that kind of unemployment in a long time. Businesses would have to contract considerably in terms of their economic activity before people would start using the D word. You know, here's the problem, Tess. Some of this is psychological. Undoubtedly, the tendency people have to go to the stores and buy things has a lot to do with how much money they have in their pocketbooks and how much they can get access to credit, how easily they can. But it also has to do with their expectations of the future. When consumer expectations drop to the cellar, as they are now dropping, the economy has a tendency to follow. So there's a kind of a downward cycle that sets in.
You mentioned the issue of credit, and it's just so hard for people to borrow money right now. Is that a new factor when we're looking at the possibility of recession or depression? Is that something that we have seen before contribute to these kinds of economic cycles?
Well, let's put it this way. It's new to the extent that the extent to which Americans are dependent on credit is new. I mean, Americans are deep in debt. We've never had this much indebtedness. And as a result, when they pull back from being in debt, that is new simply because we've never been this deeply in debt. Here we get into a paradox, because what's right and proper and appropriate for an individual, spending less money, if everybody starts being very fiscally responsible together, then we are in a very severe recession.
What's the best thing, then, that consumers, our listeners, can do to avoid kind of really panicking over the current financial situation when they hear that things really are quite bad?
Well, the first thing is not to panic. Don't take money out of your savings accounts, out of your 401ks. That will just make the situation worse. But I would say if you are earning some more money and you want to save a little bit. Probably don't put them into stocks right now. I'd also say that it does make sense for the individual consumer to get out of deep debt, to be a little bit more prudent.
Robert Reich was a labor secretary under President Clinton, and his latest book is Super Capitalism. Thanks again.
Thank you, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And Chris, you know, the Fed recently reported that this credit crunch is really affecting small businesses. And, you know, small or big, it certainly can't be easy to be a business owner right now.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Tess. But let me ask you this.
Okay.
Here's the question. Would a Business Week magazine, the iPod, and I think your favorite place, Trader Joe's grocery store, have in common?
What do they have in common? They all fit in a briefcase, except for Trader Joe's?
Okay, I think you've been doing a business show for too long, but, you know, that is true. But they were all rolled out during bad economic times. So, Tess, here's the straight story. The R word doesn't mean Armageddon for entrepreneurs. A downturn can be one of the best times to start a business or expand an existing one.
Well, that's really interesting. Why wouldn't a downturn be a business death sentence?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. One is, think about what happens during a downturn. Now, some businesses go out of business.
Right.
Other ones, you know, they're not as competitive. And so for entrepreneurs, this provides an opportunity to be more aggressive, to expand. Plus, if you have a good idea and you can save a bigger business money, you have a competitive edge because you can solve problems for other companies, which is one definition of what an entrepreneur does.
Now, you also mentioned it's a good idea to expand a small business.
I think it is a good time to expand it, but here's how. You know, when times are good, you know, you try this, you got this idea, you go out there, and what a downturn does is it forces you to focus on what is my business, where is the return on investment, and then you take some of those side businesses, however attractive they may be, and you get rid of them. That improves your cash flow so that when the boom comes, and by the way, Tess, recessions end. There will be a boom. I promise you.
Okay.
There will be a boom. So when the boom comes, you're prepared to take advantage of it.
So what you're saying is really this forces businesses to focus.
And there's some opportunities there. For example, to pick up better workers. Now, you may not have to pay them as much, or you pay them as much, but they're more skilled, they're more knowledgeable, they really help out your business. Your suppliers, they might be more willing to negotiate a deal, you know, maybe you save some money there. Not all your inputs go down, but a lot of the really critical ones do go down. And again, that's why it can be a good time to start a business.
But as we talked about, this credit crunch is affecting all kinds of things. And wouldn't it be hard for folks to borrow right now to try to open a business?
I think hard is an understatement. I think it would be impossible.
Yeah.
But most small businesses do not start with bank loans. It's friends, family, acquaintances,
sure,
the uncle that has some money, and that's how you start your business. But here's my recommendation. Go talk to that banker. Present your case, and they're going to say no. Then you go back and you say, here's how my business is evolving. No. Then business starts to do better. Credit gets a little more relaxed. They want to lend more. And you walk through the door and they go, Tess, I know you. I know your business plan. We have a good relationship. We'll lend you some money.
That's so nice of them.
Isn't it?
I really appreciate that.
Yeah. You know, so go ahead. Start your own business.
All right. The straight story from our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Tess.
So real estate websites like Zillow can be addictive.
I started seeing what my parents' house was worth, what my neighbor's houses were worth, my old boss.
But in a housing slump, they can also be lifesavers and a sunny day in the work life of an L.A. weatherman. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Home prices continued to tumble in January. The worst declines were in Miami and Las Vegas. Both dropped more than 19% from the year before. If you live in any of the hard-hit areas, you've probably tried to check out your own home price by going to websites like Zillow or Redfin. Used to be kind of fun to watch those numbers. Now, not so much. But people are relying on these sites more than ever. From the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk, Stacey Vanek-Smith reports.
Blogger Erin Kotecki-Vest started using online real estate sites when she was thinking about selling her home a few years ago. But it wasn't all business.
I started seeing what my parents' house was worth, what my neighbors' houses were worth. My old boss, I wonder what she was getting paid that she could afford that house.
Vest says online real estate sites helped her learn a lot about the housing market, and she eventually bought a home in suburban L.A. with her husband. Even after the move, Vest logged in regularly to see how much her home value had climbed. Then things turned south. Vest's home value has dropped more than 20%, and she's lost most of the equity she had in her home. And money isn't coming in like it used to. Now Vest is worried she will have trouble making future payments. She says she tried to contact her mortgage company, but they were no help.
I gave them a call. We have not missed a payment yet, but, you know, you can see the big dark cloud coming. You have to help us. And they said they would look into it, and I never received a call back.
So Vest turned to the internet for help. Informational blogs, online articles, and social networking sites like Twitter. Liz Pulliam-Weston is a personal finance columnist for MSN Money. She's gotten hundreds of letters from people like Vest, whose mortgage companies told them they can't get help until they've missed a payment. Weston says it's a big mistake to wait and recommends people go online right away to start educating themselves.
The most important thing is to get some realistic and objective advice about your situation so that you can salvage something from it. You know, maybe you will have to sell your house, but better to sell it if you can get some money back from it and preserve your credit rating than to wait and continue throwing good money after bad.
Real estate websites are trying to make themselves information centers for consumers like Vest. Zillow, Trulia, and Realtor.com have watched traffic explode as the real estate market has collapsed. Glenn Kelman is CEO of Redfin, an online brokerage site that charges a much lower commission than most agents. He says his company has seen a huge demand for more information from worried home sellers and bargain-hungry buyers.
What we did to make those houses sell a little bit better is we just started looking at all the data instead of trusting the usual sales voodoo about how to sell a house.
Kelman says Redfin did hundreds of statistical studies on topics like which day you should list your house and how important it is to stage it. He says no matter how much information Redfin offers on a property, consumers always want more. Traffic on Redfin has doubled in the last year, even as sales have dropped in half.
It feels like the appetite for information and the anxiety over being had is now infinite. That's what we take to the bank, is that because we're a broker and we have access to the MLS, we can offer this freakish depth.
That kind of freakish depth has been a lifesaver for blogger Erin Kotecki-Vest. But she says the internet has also offered an invaluable support network during a tough time.
If I were just waiting for my mortgage company to call me back, I'd lose my mind. If I didn't have the social media network of people that I could reach out to and say, hey, guys, help me on this, and within 20 minutes get 40 different recommendations. I don't know how I would find that otherwise.
Vest says she uses chat rooms and sites these companies have created to ask questions, trade information, and commiserate. About 6 months ago, Trulia.com launched Trulia Voices. CEO Pete Flint says it's been an enormous success.
We're seeing consumers ask all these questions about everything from how do foreclosures affect my local market? Is now the right time to buy or should I hold? And they're using these online forums to answer those questions. And then agents are jumping on board and helping them. So that's a really big surprise for us how popular that service is.
Of course, you can't believe everything you read. Liz Pulliam-Weston cautions against taking online information too seriously. She says the internet is a great place to start, but recommends talking with a HUD housing counselor before making major decisions. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace Money.
And next weekend, join us for a special program we're calling Homesick, a full hour looking at the housing market morass. This week, yet another student loan lender announced it's not issuing any more new loans. Brazos Higher Education Service Corporation joined more than 30 other institutions that are pulling back from student lending because of the credit crunch and lower federal subsidies. Many have also stopped making consolidation loans. But for students who are still hoping to consolidate, SmartMoney.com reporter Anna Maria Andriotis says, hang on.
This is actually the first time in a very long time that consolidating student loans is a bad idea. We have two different types of student loans that we need to keep in mind. There's variable rate student loans and there's fixed rate student loans.
What do most students have?
Up until July of 2006, every student who applied for a federal loan got a variable rate student loan. Fixed rate student loans did not exist. So right now, there's a good chunk of students, most likely, and especially students who are still in school, maybe students who recently graduated, who are probably juggling both variable rate and fixed rate student loans.
Okay. Well, then let's go ahead and start with the variable rate. Where does that fit in this whole issue of consolidation?
Basically, if you're holding on to a variable rate student loan and you haven't consolidated it yet, you don't want to consolidate it right now. What you want to do is you want to wait until July 1st. That's because every year on July 1st, the rates for the variable rate student loans reset.
What kind of difference is it going to be in rates from now till then?
Right now, for somebody who's holding on to a variable rate student loan, the current interest rate on that is 7.22%. If you consolidate these loans right now, you're going to get a slightly higher interest rate, 7.25%. If you wait a few months, it's projected that your rate will be 3.5%.
Okay, that's a pretty major difference.
Yes, that is a very significant difference.
So that's variable rate loans. What if you only have fixed rate loans? Should you consolidate then?
The main purpose of consolidating your student loans used to be that you have all these loans, they all have these variable rates. Why not bring them all together and get one fixed rate? Well, with fixed rate loans, that's kind of really not an issue anymore because your rate will remain the same throughout the entire life of that loan. Until the moment that you have a zero balance on that loan, your rate will remain the same. Consolidating them would make no sense at this point.
So the key here is that folks should simply wait until July 1st.
Exactly. Now, several sources who I spoke with who track, in general, the variable rate student loans have said to me that it's basically a guarantee that the official rates that will be locked in for the variable rate loans will be at historical lows. If not the historical low, one of the lowest rates ever.
So this would be a good time for all kinds of folks with student loans to really take a look at refinancing those, right?
Not exactly. Once you consolidate your student loans, it's very hard to refinance them. Even if you do, you're not going to lock in that low rate that's coming up on July 1st.
Okay. Anna Maria Andreotis writes for SmartMoney.com. Thanks for educating us on student loans.
Thank you.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thriveand.com/retirement.
Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
All right, it's time for Getting Personal, and that's when we answer your money questions. And back with me, as always, is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. And our first caller is Pamela. She is in Wilmar, Minnesota. Hi, Pamela.
Hi.
Tell us a little bit about your question for Chris today.
Well, I'm a retired educator, and during those years, I saved in 403B plans and also one Roth IRA.
Okay.
And as I was doing my planning for retirement, I was told I needed to change my 403Bs into straight IRAs. And I'm a little confused by that and am wondering if it's something I should be doing, and if so, what the advantages are for me.
Okay. Well, Chris, is this something that she should do? Do you have to get out of your 403B or 401K and put it into an IRA?
Well, part of it depends on the rules of the pension plan, and there's a great deal of flexibility there. But whether or not it is part of the rules or it isn't part of the rules, I'm a big believer when you retire or you move to another job that in most cases it makes sense to take that 403B and do what's called a rollover IRA. And I think there's some very good reasons to do that.
What are the advantages?
Well, the main advantage, your employer's a good person. And there's lots of rules and regulations that they need to be responsible with that money. but you're no longer an employee. So the reason why I like people to take their money out of the 403B and do a rollover IRA is that it's now your responsibility. You're on top of it. You care about it. Plus, you get to invest it where you want. So there may be a mutual fund company you want to do business with, or there's some mutual fund options that you want to pursue.
Chris, is there any cost to rolling over from a 403B or 401K into an IRA?
Typically, no, because they want the money. Now, there will be costs once you do the rollover and you choose your mutual fund options and you'll have your annual fees, you know, your expense ratio, all of that to be paying. But typically, there is no cost associated most of the time.
And no tax consequences?
As long as you do what we call an institution-to-institution transfer, you're going from one tax-sheltered account into another tax-sheltered account. You don't want the account to come into your hands.
You don't want to cash out.
You don't want to cash out. Avoid that. It's routine, but you don't want the money to touch your hands because you don't want any tax consequences.
So, Pamela, it sounds like you were already on the right track.
Very good.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
If you've got a money question, we've got the answer. Just visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right, Chris, let's reach into the email bag. And Stephanie writes in from Morocco, Indiana.
Okay. For a second there, I was thinking, oh, from Morocco.
That's what I thought, too. But no, she's in Indiana, and she works as a biologist for a nonprofit organization. But this is very exciting. She's got an offer from a smaller nonprofit for a new job, and she's very interested, although it would require her to move. But here's the question. The new job would have some major changes in terms of what she is getting. She's looking at a lower salary, higher health insurance premiums, and no retirement savings plan. And her current employer provides an 8% match to what she contributes to the retirement plan. So she's wondering if there's any sort of tool, either online or otherwise, where she can calculate what kind of impact this might have on her finances. Or is it just a matter of following her heart?
Well, let's first get the finances and really look at what are the financial implications of making this move, because it's not just lower salary and, what did you say, higher health care premiums.
Right.
And
no retirement savings.
No retirement savings. Plus, there's the cost of moving, and that can be very expensive. Mm-hmm. And then there's the issues of the cost of living where she is right now. You know, if you think about rental or home ownership, utilities, that type of thing can vary a lot depending on where you move in the country. So you also want to take those into account. You can go to a website like monster.com, and it has a salary comparison, cost of living calculators. Payday.com is another one. Salary.com, it has some calculators.
So those are places where she can plug in the numbers and kind of get a feel for what her cost of living is going to be and what these different changes, what kind of effect that might have.
That's right. Now, before we go heart versus finance, there's one other thing to calculate in there. The standard piece of advice is that when you make a job change, you always go for a higher salary, right?
Right.
But I had a friend, and one time he always stuck with me. He said, you know, he'd made 5 job changes, and every single job change, he'd taken a lower salary and advanced his career because he made a move toward a better organization or a different organization, and he ended up making more money. But the main aspect of these job changes was to improve his long-term career prospects. If she does make this move, will she get better job offers in the future? So we got this sort of short-term financial calculation and this longer-term career calculation.
All right. Well, long-term or short-term, if you've got a question, do give us a call. Our phone number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. And now we're answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link and stay tuned for more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. You know, I used to live east of the Mississippi, and like a lot of other folks, I'd occasionally mock all those weirdos out in California. But now I live in California. And on weeks like the one we just had, with flooding in Arkansas, rain and snow heading through the Midwest and Northeast, while L.A. boasts sun and 80-some degrees, it's hard not to think the weirdos are onto something. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we meet a SoCal weatherman.
Good evening to you. We're 80 plus and getting warmer. And what about the winds? I've got it all in my live Weather Plus forecast just ahead.
I'm Fritz Coleman. I'm the weekday weather forecaster at Channel 4 NBC in Los Angeles. And next December, it'll be 25 years that I've been employed here by some miracle of science. I am not a licensed meteorologist. I was a stand-up comedian and a comedy writer. I have a degree in snappy banter. My job is to communicate the weather. I don't do the science. I present it on television. We get it from the National Weather Service, which anyone can use. It's a taxpayer-supported service. And we get it from two meteorologists that we have on retainer. I work from noon to 6:30 to the end of the 6 o'clock news, and then I have about a three-hour break, and I come back at 9 or 9:30 and work till midnight doing the 11 o'clock news live. I have to create my whole presentation. I download the weather information. I decide what my weather story is going to be. I decide what graphic elements I need to tell that story, and I create the graphics myself and prepare the forecast myself. And it takes me about 3 hours to prepare for it. I make embarrassingly more than a school teacher, but less than most Silicon Valley moguls. It's a six-figure salary in larger markets. We're accurate probably 85 to 90% of the time, up to 48 hours, and then it tapers off precipitously after that. People love human quality, so it almost gives you more credibility to make a mistake and to admit it, because being a weatherman is learning to suffer public humiliation gracefully. And people are positive, they're negative, they give us too much credit, they think we control the weather, they think we can predict the weather for weddings 2 years out, they blame us if things have gone awry, they give us way too much credit. And my answer to them is, I'm in sales, not management. One night I was in the supermarket at midnight, and a man came up to me and said, I love you, I've been watching you for years, but I just want to tell you how what you do affects people's lives. About 2 weeks ago, you said it was going to rain on Saturday, and I had an outdoor wedding reception for my daughter, and I rented a tent that cost $6,000, and I just want you to know that that Saturday was the most beautiful day we'd seen in a long time, and thank you very much for the sunshine. And he winked and walked away instead of hammering me or suing me for the cost of the tent for the inaccurate forecast. And there's a lot of guilt connected with it when you blow it that badly. I don't get jealous of people who get to work in places like Kansas, where on any given day the weather can pick your home up and throw it through the Sears and Roebuck. I love to be on television and be in a position to put a smile on people's faces every day. My forecast between April and October is morning clouds and fog, hazy afternoon sun. I have the least threatening part of the news. Weather forecast is the palate cleanser between the tragedy and the sports. That's what I like about it.
We've got more about weatherman Fritz Coleman and his job at marketplace.org. A Day in the Work Life was reported by Francesca Segre. Coming up, grumpy economy plus record high gold prices equals a trip to the pawn shop.
For a piece like this, before I would consider melting it, I would try polishing it up a little bit and maybe selling it on eBay.
You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Wouldn't it be nice if during tough economic times, when your savings account is running kind of low, the Fed would look at you and say, hey, I like you. Let me arrange for a $30 billion loan. Unfortunately, that privilege is reserved for the likes of Bear Stearns. For the rest of us, it might be time to get a second job, maybe even sell the family jewels. Here's reporter Jamie Bedrin.
My husband Scott and I are starting a baby fund. Even though babies are small, we hear they're expensive, and we live in New York City, where everything is overpriced. We figure it wouldn't hurt to comb through our stuff and see what we could sell, especially with the price of gold so high. I decided to think outside the box, or in this case, with my box, my jewelry box. My first stop, a Fifth Avenue jeweler named Frank Pollock. He's been in the bling business for four decades.
Hi, Jim. Hi, thanks so much for agreeing to meet.
Pollock says whenever the price of gold spikes, people rush to unload old jewelry, mostly stuff they don't wear or things they inherited or received as gifts.
When it approached 800, which was the previous high from 1979, when it got to be 800, people came running to sell gold quickly. There was a big flurry of people selling what they had.
Do you mind if I show you some of my things?
My pleasure.
Okay. I brought a couple things. that are mine, that are my mother's, things that were family pieces.
Yeah. Let's see what this is. This is Barry Kieselstein cord, and this actually has more value as jewelry than it does as scrap.
It's a thick gold link necklace. Pollock says there's always a market for this type of jewelry. He says it's worth $6,000, but it's my mother's, and I don't think she'd be happy with me if I sold it. As for my stuff, Pollock says he'd only pay a few hundred dollars for it.
This is 149th Street Grand Concourse.
Back on the train, I head uptown to a pawn shop in the Bronx. It's called Pawnbrokers, Inc.
How much are you looking for?
40.
It's not what I expect. It's clean, well-lit, not scary-looking. Blaine Messenger owns the place. He says pawn shops have evolved.
Most pawn shops, the ones that are thriving, are going to busy areas, and they're putting in clean retail store-like outlets that don't look like a small little mom-and-pop store.
The place isn't that busy. I figured with the shaky economy, people would be ready to sell their stuff. But Messenger says most customers stop by for small, short-term loans, the kind of loan that's tough to get from a bank, especially if you don't have good credit.
The bad thoughts of it are gone. Like, people are now realizing that there is a place out there that they could go get $200, $300, $500 for a month or two.
Messenger says 85 to 90% of his customers redeem their merchandise, usually within a few weeks. The pawnbroker collects 4% interest on the loan. But it's not a loan I'm interested in. I want to offload this gold choker my mother gave me. It's so 80s. Back on the train. I'm headed to Midtown, to New York City's Diamond District, for a rendezvous with jeweler Roman Maliev. When he weighs my necklace, he says my cash-out value would be a shade more than $400. That seemed a little low to me.
For a piece like this, I mean, it still seems to be in pretty much good shape. Before I would consider melting it.
Melting it?
I would try, let's say, maybe just polishing it up a little bit and cleaning it up and maybe selling it on eBay, you know, and getting a couple of more dollars for it.
Maliev says it's a great time to sell your stuff. He's fielding calls from clients from all over the world right now wanting to invest in gold. And that gets me thinking, rather than handing over my necklace for a paltry $400, maybe I'll hold off. After all, with the price of gold soaring and the commodities market going crazy, you never know. It could be worth something someday. In New York, I'm Jamie Bedrin for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. By Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
We're back again with Getting Personal, and as always, I'm joined by our own Chris Farrell, our personal finance expert. And Chris, let's go ahead and hit the phones again. Suzanne is on the line from Thiensville, Wisconsin. Hi, Suzanne.
Hello.
So what's your question for Chris today?
Well, my husband and I normally give a set dollar amount to charities each month. What we were thinking about doing is investing that money each month into a socially responsible mutual fund, and then letting it grow a little bit, hopefully, and then transferring those shares to different charities. So I started looking at the available funds, and I was wondering, is there such a thing as a socially responsible index fund?
This is a question that we get quite often, Chris, actually, about socially responsible investing. And first of all, let's congratulate Suzanne on her magnanimity. Can I ask how much you generally set aside for charitable contributions?
About $800 a month.
Good for you. Wow, that's terrific. Well, Chris, let's get right to her question. Are there socially responsible index funds?
There are a number of socially responsible index funds. For example, Vanguard, which really is the pioneer in indexing for mutual funds. They have the FTSE index, and it's based on the FTSE For Good U.S. Select Index. Calvert has one. I'd also would take a close look at the TIAA-CREF Social Choice Fund. That's another one. And you can do some research on the various index funds at socialinvest.org.
Now, Suzanne, you mentioned that you wanted to then transfer some of the shares after hopefully they've gained in value. Chris, Do most charitable organizations allow the transfer of mutual fund shares?
Most charitable organizations do, particularly your more established charitable organizations with brand names. New ones that just opened up for business, they may not be able to take the shares.
Does that help you out, Suzanne?
Yeah, that's great. Thank you so much.
Well, charitable or non-charitable, we do love talking about your investments. So visit our website, we're at marketplace.org, and click on the Getting Personal link. All right, let's go to one more email. And Ariana writes in from Yukon, Oklahoma. She is a junior at an Oklahoma State University. She's taken out about $3,000 in loans each semester. Ouch.
Yeah.
But her mother has just informed her that she has about $2,000 in savings bonds.
Ah.
It's kind of like finding a $10 bill in your pocket. No, actually, it's not like that at all. It's $2,000.
It's like $2,000.
So her mother wants her to use the savings bonds instead of a loan for one of the semesters. But Ariana thinks she should use it to pay off interest on her existing loans. What do you think?
Well, I'm with Mom. I would not borrow for the semester that you don't need to. But let's go with an impartial observer. I'd go to the financial aid office and say, would you please run the numbers for me? Or you can call your student loan lender. They'll run the numbers for you. And then you can make an informed decision.
So they can basically help her figure out the math on how much interest she could save by paying off for one semester, or how much she could save by simply paying down some of the interest on the loan she already took out.
Exactly. It's easy for them to do. And in this sense, they're your friend. In other senses, maybe not. But in this sense, they're an ally.
Well, Chris, let me pose a question that Ariana didn't ask, but I'm curious. You know, she has this $2,000 now, and we're always talking about saving for the future, that you've got to get a retirement plan going as soon as you possibly can. And you've talked about how student loan debt is actually good debt. So would there be any reason for her to take this $2,000 and, say, put it in a Roth instead of putting any of it toward the student loan debt?
You know, that's an intriguing question. I wouldn't put it necessarily for retirement, but what about this thought? She's a junior, right? You said she's a junior.
Right.
So she's going to be graduating soon. And when you graduate from college, there can be a lot of expenses at that time. Perhaps you're going to move to a different town, a different city to take a job, or you need a new wardrobe depending on the job that you're taking, or you know, you've gotten away with not having a car for the 4 years at college, but now you've got a real commute. So, you know, it's nice to have a pot of savings when you graduate to get you through these transitions into the employed work world.
All right. Well, thank you for the email, Ariana. And unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show. But Chris, as we mentioned before, is now answering your personal finance questions online every weekday. Just visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link there. Of course, you can always call us as well at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I love the field of behavioral economics. At last, someone trying to figure out why I, and you, I'm guessing, make such utterly irrational decisions involving money. When I saw MIT professor Dan Ariely's new book, Predictably Irrational, I knew I had to talk to him. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tell us briefly about one of the earlier experiments in your book, which had to do with Social Security numbers. How did this demonstrate predictable irrationality?
We went to a big class of students with six products. And after they finished examining them, we asked them to write the last two digits of the Social Security numbers. So what's yours, for example?
60.
So you will write 60 next to each of those products.
Okay.
And then we would ask you whether hypothetically you would pay $60 for each of those products. And you would say yes or no. Now we said we will have an auction and everybody is asked to bid for each of those items. And then we calculated the correlation between people's Social Security numbers and their bid. So in fact, if you look at the people that their number ended between 0 and 20, you would have bid much lower numbers for these items. And the people who ended between 80 and 99, those people are willing to pay sometimes 3 or 4 times more for the same items.
So that really teaches us then, doesn't it, that we are very much prompted by whatever our surrounding is, whatever we're kind of used to.
That's right. Imagine that tomorrow somebody doubles the price of milk and halves the price of alcohol. What would happen? And I'm guessing that people would have less calcium and will walk a little happier in the streets. Right? We will remember the price of yesterday and we will behave accordingly. We will stop buying milk and start buying alcohol. Now, what would happen if the same price changes were also accompanied by amnesia? We wouldn't remember any prices that we paid in the past. In that case, I'm assuming that our sensitivity to these price changes will be much, much lower. And that's part of the point, is that we don't really have a true reservation price. And part of what we are making decisions about is a reaction to the prices of the market and not as a function of our own preferences.
I want to toss a couple of questions back to you that you ask in the book and get your take on them. One is, why are we willing to splurge on a really nice meal, but then we go home and cut coupons for the grocery store?
Part of the answer is that we think about money in relative terms. If we're in a restaurant and it's going to cost us $150 anyway, what's another $50? But we're in the grocery store and there's tomato for $2 and there's tomato for $3.50, that looks like a tremendous difference.
And I love this one. Why do our headaches not go away after 1 cent aspirin, but like magic, they're gone after a 50-cent one?
What we found was that when you have a cold medication that you buy on full price, you expect this cold medication to work, and indeed it works better. And when you get a cold medication on discount, you expect it to be worse, and indeed it's worse. Expectations are not just things in our mind. They are the tools by which we see reality, and they actually play a role in making the reality different.
If we are such predictably irrational creatures, what's the best way for us to recognize our own behavior and try to change it?
I think there's some things we understand that we're irrational and we're already starting to fight it, and there's some things we don't understand. So think about savings. How much do you think would be the saving rate in the U.S. if we didn't have 401k plans? Presumably, it would be much lower. Now, what's the magic of 401k? It has the matching contribution, which is a part of the answer, but it also has the issue of deducting the amount of money at the beginning of the month. It's not under our discretion. So the main lesson is that we have to understand where we fall short and come up with mechanisms. There could be mechanisms that take decision out of our control, like, you know, 401k, or there could be things that use other things that we care about to get us to do the things that we actually don't seem to be doing. And I'll give you one example for this. AARP a few years ago spent about $4 million on a campaign to try and get people to walk. It turns out it's just very hard to get people to walk. But we did a little study in which we got people to arrange meetings with other people. And you know what? When people have a meeting with somebody else to walk with them, they just don't cancel those meetings. So we created a mechanism that got them to behave better in a way that was good for them.
So we can become predictably rational.
I think we can understand where we fail and we can try and fix some of those things. But it's not easy.
Dan Ariely is the author of Predictably Irrational, Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions. Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Every few weeks, we kick back and hand things over to you and your comments about our show. Yes, it is time for listener letters. And who knew so many of you were mountaineering enthusiasts? Leading into a recent Day in the Work Life segment, I credited Sir Edmund Hillary with saying, "Because it's there," in response to a question about why he climbed Mount Everest. In fact, as many of you pointed out, the source of that quotation is George Mallory. Mallory was among the first climbers to attempt Everest, but did not survive his third expedition in 1924. Ron Bildstein of Syracuse, New York, takes me and Chris to task for our discussion during a Straight Story segment a couple of weeks ago. We said just about everyone on Main Street and Wall Street now agrees we are in a recession, even if nobody wants to say it officially. Ron thinks we need to chill.
Why do you place your program in the realm of what I'll call pop economics? That's when the media talks the economy into a recession. Why not contribute to true economic literacy as the tone of your program purports to do and generally delivers?
Rachel Rockefeller also urges us to focus more on the basics. She listens to us in Bozeman, Montana, and heard my recent profile of the Crow River Investment Club in Minneapolis. You get too far off the point, she writes. speaking about investment clubs is a waste of time. That's not the way for people to do well long term. Investment clubs are more like gambling than sound investment advice. We received lots of feedback on our special program on the Middle East and Muslim financing. Many of you thanked us for providing a window on life in the region. But Drew Butler says we missed one driving force behind personal finance there.
I did not hear anyone mention the two-hour auto commutes, which are common in the United Arab Emirates. Also, inflation in the area has been 25% higher in the last 2 years and is projected to be 15% higher in 2008. On the other hand, I would have never had the opportunity to meet all the wonderful and varied people I have met from all over the world if I had not come here.
Drew lives in and contacted us from Doha, Qatar. He's originally from Mobile, Alabama. We love getting your comments, compliments, and yes, even complaints. Go to marketplace.org and click on contact. And if you've missed part of this show or any other, there's a full archive on the website as well. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, grim stories from the home front.
This is my house, but it's not really my house anymore. Really, any day we'll get notice of the date for the court sale.
I remember when those people moved out, they were selling everything, their TVs and everything. But most people just disappear.
Join us for Homesick, an hour-long look at the ailing housing market. Marketplace Money is produced by John Haas with Rico Galliano, Stephen Hoffman, James Richter, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Viglund. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.